I next met with Dr. Jaffer Ajani from MD Anderson Cancer Center, who discussed recent guidelines regarding HER2 testing in patients with gastric or gastroesophageal cancer issued by the College of American Pathologists, the American Society for Clinical Pathology, and the American Society of Clinical Oncology.
HER2 testing, I think there's this big literature on breast cancer, as you well know, for many years. And it is quite limited for gastric cancer. It's all limited to retrospective study, one prospective study. So ASCO, College of American Pathologists, and American Society of Clinical Pathology, they all came together and prepared a guideline which is in press at the moment and should come out in about 2-3 months. I can tell you that a couple of things that we wanted to emphasize is that you can select the primary tumor or metastatic tumor. It doesn't really matter. More samples you study, that is better than less samples. So most of the time we depend on one section of the biopsy, and that may not be enough. So there is not good information out there on that. But people have done some retrospective work. So if a patient has multiple unprocessed tumor material, pathologists have taken 2, 3, and 4 random samples from different blocks and showed that HER2 positivity will go up if you do more. So there's no clear guidance, but we are saying that if you have access to more samples, it's better to do it before you conclude that HER2 is positive or negative in a given patient.
And of course, you're referring to the issue of tumor heterogeneity. Is there any reason to believe there's more heterogeneity in terms of HER2 in gastric than breast cancer?
So there is. You know, I think you're exactly right. So this was the basic premise to distinguish between HER2 testing in breast cancer and gastric cancer. So even the scoring system is different. It's more liberal for gastric cancer because of heterogeneity. So for example, if you find only 5 cells that have the HER2 stain, for example, you can score it. And that is quite different from breast cancer. So that's one issue. The second is that we wanted to make sure that the clinical oncologists don't wait around for HER2 results when they are trying to treat a patient. So what we recommended that you start your chemotherapy, you order your HER2 test, and when the HER2 test comes back, you can act on that 2 weeks down the line rather than just waiting around, which was done in the TOGA trial.
Although, you know, if you think about it, I mean, in breast cancer, they wait for the HER2 results, so there must be a mechanism to get it done fairly quickly.
Right. So I think in the guidelines, you will see that we recommend no more than 10 business days. We wanted 3 business days. And there was a lot of bickering about that. And then it came down to 10 business days, which is 2 weeks. So it can get delayed considerably. And the gastric cancer patients are much more symptomatic than breast cancer patients. I'm talking about stage 4 patients.
Yeah, that's a good point. Of course, the key thing is the type of test. You know, in breast cancer, initially there was a lot of back and forth about what to do. It kind of settled into an IHC first. And then if it's not definitive, i.e. 1 or 2+, then FISH. What about in gastric cancer? What did this panel conclude?
It is just that. So we said do the IHC first. And if it is 3+, you don't have to do anything else. If it is 0 or 1, also you don't need to do anything. And if it is 2+, then you check for copy number.
So in terms of the epidemiology of this, do we have any better numbers? I remember in the beginning, people are talking about 15 or 20% of gastric cancer being HER2 positive, kind of similar to breast cancer. Then I was hearing people saying, wow, we never see it. What's it shaken out to?
Yeah, it is quite a bit lower than initial publications. So it's down to, I would say it's down to 8%. And more patients we test, you know, less patients have positivity.
You know, globally, when you look at these patients with metastatic disease, in general, do they live longer or the same amount of time as HER2-negative patients?
So literature is very contradictory, and that is a section in the guidelines that addresses the prognostic implications. So there is no conclusive prognostic implication. There are papers that say it confers poor prognosis, and then there are papers with, I'm talking about 1,000 patient papers. And then there are papers that say there's no correlation. So not like breast cancer, here there is really no prognostic implication of HER2 positivity. But I want to mention that HER2-3 plus by immunohistochemistry patients really considerably benefit from trastuzumab, and some can live very long time. I have patients living like 12 and 13 years, and this is before the inception of the TOGA trial, because we were doing HER2 testing and trying to get trastuzumab approved. So several patients have survived very long time. In terms of how to deal with the test, you know, there is only evidence to show benefit in first line setting with the addition of trastuzumab. And after that, all the other trials are really negative. The lapatinib trial, the T-DM1 trial, the high dose trastuzumab trial, all these trials turned out to be negative. There is only one pending trial at the moment.
Could I just ask you, though, because I've heard the statement made, quote, the T-DM1 trial was negative. And yet, I want to ask you about that, because I don't know, to my eyes, I'm not exactly sure why people made that conclusion. So maybe you could just review. This was, I guess, initially presented earlier this year, a phase 2-3 study of trastuzumab emtansine, T-DM1, obviously used in breast cancer, second-line therapy all the time, versus a taxane in previously treated HER2-positive disease. Can you talk about what the study showed and why you feel it's, quote, negative?
So it was a really innovative design where there was a randomized phase 2 component, and then close to 300-plus patients were compared with the taxane. And it turned out that, yes, the T-DM1 arm did have a response rate. I think it was close to 20%. But there was no difference in the primary endpoint, which is the overall survival. So sort of disappointing. And it may be that, you know, HER2 resistance is already developed and the cancer cells are no longer using HER2 machinery for multiplication and migration. They're using another pathway. So you can inhibit all you want. It doesn't affect the cancer progression. And this has been shown in the EGFR inhibition also through our group, that basically at the transcription level, the EGFR receptor is upregulated. So you have a constant EGFR coming to the surface of the cell, but the cell is driven by like a stem cell pathway, like a Hippo pathway. So this may be the case for HER2 also.
So can I tell you my own naive look at this? I don't know anything about it. It's just when I looked at this paper and why I wondered why it's considered negative. As you said, a objective response rate of 20%. This is in 200 patients in the T-DM1 arm. A lot of patients had objective responses to an agent which we know from breast cancer has very little toxicity, does not have chemotoxicity. So why is this not an option? You have 20% of people objective responses to a non-toxic agent. Why wouldn't you want to consider using it?
So, yeah, I was using it before this study was completed, and almost every patient had a response. I think the problem is that in gastric cancer, FDA still wants survival advantage, not like breast cancer where you can have other endpoints like time to progression and maybe even fast track response approval. But in gastric cancer, since we have only two lines of therapy approved, there's really not much going on in gastric cancer. Unfortunately, we haven't made much progress. So I think FDA still wants to see survival advantage.
Well, the FDA might want to see survival advantage, but I guess my question, as a clinician, you say that you've administered this therapy to patients. First of all, has your observation been that it's relatively non-toxic?
It is. It is relatively non-toxic, yes.
I mean, it does not cause alopecia, you know, GI, chemo side effects. Is that your experience?
It is. Occasionally thrombocytopenia, but that's it.
Right. Thrombocytopenia, LFTs. But, I mean, would you want to have it available? Were the responses that you saw clinically useful? Were you happy the patient got the drug?
Yes, we want therapy for these patients. As we discussed earlier, that these are very symptomatic patients. In the first line setting, they are very symptomatic. So in second line setting, they're even more symptomatic. And really, there aren't many drugs that can produce response. And we will probably come to ramucirumab, but ramucirumab by itself produces a 3% response rate. So that's not really a helpful drug by itself. So we need drug with higher response rate for this population.
So another thing that you hear a lot of discussion about is in second line therapy of HER2 positive disease is the same issue that we've heard about for many, many years in breast cancer, which is, do you continue the anti-HER therapy on disease progression and, for example, change the chemotherapy? Now, that's commonly done. As a matter of fact, it's state of the art in terms of breast cancer. But when we've polled investigators and general oncologists, we see a substantial number will do it, particularly if the patient responds to first line, but a substantial number don't do it. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I think we concluded that we cannot recommend it in second line. And that's because of these two negative studies. You know, the lapatinib second line study, which was when the patients progress on trastuzumab-based therapy and they get on the second line HER2-targeted therapy. So lapatinib, T-DM1. So based on that, I think at least the gastric community is not going to use it. Now, I have continued for, you know, I have a patient who is 11 years out with trastuzumab, another one is 10 years out. So I have used it in the past, and now I use it as maintenance. So the patient comes in, they have a great response to cytotoxic plus trastuzumab, and then they cannot continue the cytotoxics, such as oxaliplatin. Then we just continue maintenance on them for years sometimes.
So just to finish out on HER2-positive disease, you brought in a case here today, a 53-year-old man. Sounds really interesting. I guess you saw him initially 10 years ago. Can you talk about this patient?
Right. So patient had multiple lung metastases and lymphadenopathy in the abdomen, adenocarcinoma at the GE junction. And this is in the days where there was no trial. So I was doing HER2 testing in all my patients, and this gentleman turned out to have a 3+ by IHC. So we got approval, fortunately, from the insurance company and started him on that. And he's in that scenario that I mentioned previously, had a dramatic response. He did have one persistent lung lesion that we biopsied and then stereotactically treated that. So he had additional treatment in addition to maintenance of trastuzumab. So if we just look at the trastuzumab data from TOGA, what was published in Lancet was very dramatic, like 2.5 month delta in the median survivorship. And the hazard ratio was like 0.73. But the trial was not done in US. So FDA actually required them to give longer follow-up. And so with longer follow-up, all this delta diminished almost by 50%. So the delta is now 1.4 months, just like any anti-angiogenic agent. The hazard ratio is 0.8. So what that means to me is that there is a subgroup of patients who are going to really benefit dramatically with addition of trastuzumab. Most patients don't.
Now, this patient is still on trastuzumab?
He is still on trastuzumab. We just check his ejection fraction every 6 months, and he's doing great. And I don't know whether to stop it or continue, because I was going by the breast literature at the time. Everything I could learn from breast literature, I kind of implemented for, you know, patients like him.
So let's talk about new approaches to HER2-negative gastroesophageal cancers. But before we get to the typical adenocarcinoma, just a word about squamous cell cancers of the esophagus and particularly emerging data on checkpoint inhibitors.
Yeah. So the new thing is that close to 50% of squamous cell carcinomas have PD-L1 expression. So that's really good. The second thing is there is now emerging data that if you do a biopsy before chemoradiation and do biopsy of the persistent tumor after chemoradiation, there is upregulation of PD-L1. So PD-L1, as we know in lung cancer and others, is an indication of what is called non-genomic resistance. So in other words, there is no acquisition of a mutation or alteration of DNA. There is no increase in copy number. It's just upregulation of the machinery that already exists, and that confers resistance. So in other words, if you threaten the tumor with treatment, it also thinks that now the immune system is going to go after it, and it will upregulate molecules like PD-L1, galectin-3, galectin-1, galectin-9. So what all these molecules do is they actually kill the T cells. So if you have activated T cell and you shine a little bit of PD-L1, it will induce apoptosis in that T cell. So that is sort of new, and we are about to launch a protocol where we'll be using the PD-1 inhibitor, but also another treatment arm will be the combination of PD-1 plus CTLA-4 inhibitors. And you well know that that combination is dramatic in melanoma, in lung cancer, and also in gastric cancer.
So have patients with squamous cell carcinoma of the esophagus been treated with checkpoint inhibitors? Do we know if any responses have been observed?
Yes, they have been treated, and it's only in the abstract form, but the response rate is close to 20%, very similar to a lot of other malignancies.
Have you yourself had any patients treated that way?
Yes.
Have you seen patients with clinically useful responses?
Right. So there are responses similar to other malignancies where the responses come a little bit later, and then they are very durable. So yes, I think that phenomenon is seen in esophageal cancer and in gastric cancer, both.
And have you attempted to access a checkpoint inhibitor, a PD-1 antibody that's already approved to treat squamous cell cancer of the esophagus?
Well, I'm just doing that in one patient, but for adenocarcinoma patient, several of my patients have been able to get it directly from the pharma, compassionate basis, or through their insurance. So I think that's a good situation that's occurring out there.
So in terms of esophageal, and I'll ask you about gastric since you brought it up, based on what we know right now, at what point would you attempt to access it? Second line? First line? When?
So right now I would say we should go for second and later lines. First line, I think we still have the combination of a platinum compound and a fluoropyrimidine. That produces a good response rate, close to 50%. And I don't think anything can beat it at the moment. There are attempts to usurp the chemotherapy, which will be a good thing, but we have to wait for those trials.
I guess the situation you hear other people talk about, you know, Hodgkin lymphoma is the last one I heard of, is the elderly patient who really is a poor candidate for chemotherapy. In that situation with, again, squamous of the esophagus or adeno of the stomach, would you attempt to use a PD-1 antibody up front?
If I can get it, yes. Because squamous population, as we mentioned, they are really nutritionally behind and they're not very active people. So this kind of drug may be useful for them.
Anything else in terms of esophageal cancer that's come out in terms of clinical research or biology over this past year or so?
So biology, I think there's a lot of literature now. There is a paper in revision from TCGA that is looking at close to 200 cases. They have squamous cell carcinoma and adenocarcinoma, and there are distinct differences in terms of molecular biology. So in squamous carcinoma, for example, P53 is not functional either because of mutation or because of other molecules that cause degradation of P53, like MADAM1 and MADAM2. So there is loss of P53 function more often in squamous than it is in adeno, and there are more mutations in squamous than in adenocarcinoma. In adenocarcinoma, what you see is all these amplifications because chromosomal instability. And I think it's going to be a growing challenge for us as to how to deal with, you know, everybody's talking about personalized medicine, and it's going to be a real challenge. So if I may mention a little bit about that ASCO paper, the second part was really looking at the molecular biology, immune biology of gastric cancer. So we know that there are four genotypes of gastric cancer out of the TCGA analysis, and there is a Korean study that is described in that paper. They also had 300 cases, but they were all from single institution, and they did not really study as many platforms as the TCGA did. TCGA studied six different platforms. So it's kind of an integrated, fabulous analysis. And so the four genotypes teach us something. So there are two particular ones, and this is also known in colon cancer. One is the MSI high. It's about 20% of population that have a lot of mutations and a lot of PI3 kinase alteration. And then there is an EBV compartment, which is very small, about 9%, with a lot of lymphocyte infiltration, a lot of EBV DNA incorporated in the cancer genome, and amplification of PD-L1, PD-L2, JAK1, JAK2. So this sort of gives us some handle on which group of patients might benefit from immune modulation. And then there's a large compartment, about 50% chromosomally instable, that have amplification of some of the tyrosine kinase genes, where we've been successful only with HER2 and not successful with c-MET, for example. FGF is being investigated. EGFR amplifications, that doesn't really work. So there are a lot of challenges there. And finally, we have the genomically stable, very curious group where most patients have diffuse type of phenotype, and that's the worst prognosis with minimum alterations. So we don't understand how the cancer is managing to be so aggressive without a lot of changes in the DNA. And there's not a lot of epigenomic alteration either. So this is a very curious finding.
Just to pick up on this issue, we started to talk about it related to esophageal cancer, but also in gastric cancer of checkpoint inhibitors. I want to ask if you could present your 63-year-old man who with a metastatic HER2-negative gastroesophageal junction cancer, initially presented with localized cancer. What happened when he was first diagnosed? How was he managed?
So, you know, he was managed with chemoradiation, and just before surgery, he had a mass in the pleural cavity that was biopsied and was proven to be stage 4 adenocarcinoma. And he was treated with systemic therapy and progressed. So he went on anti-PD-L1 trial that we had at the moment and had a complete remission for about 11 months. So even to date, he does not have that pleural base mass. He developed something at the base of the skull that was biopsied, and then we were able to retreat him. He responded briefly again, but then when he was treated with ramucirumab and paclitaxel, he had a dramatic response after that. So it's a very curious case. So one of my colleagues is now pursuing the idea that maybe when you do immune modulation, the tumor becomes very sensitive to treatment. So we're trying to look at cases where what happens to them after you do immunotherapy, whether they have a different outlook compared to other patients.
What's his current situation?
So patient continues on paclitaxel ramucirumab.
How long has he been on the treatment?
I think more than 6 months at the moment.
Interesting. Which agent, anti-PD-1 agent, did he receive?
We had a BMS trial, and they're not developing that molecule anymore. So they started with anti-PD-L1 molecule, and when they acquired anti-PD-1, they're just moving along with anti-PD-1 plus anti-CTLA-4.
So he actually got an anti-PD-L1 agent.
That's right.
And of course, we do now have one approved, atezolizumide, in bladder cancer. Incidentally, any take in terms of whether anti-PD-L1 is going to be any different than PD-1?
So I think the general feeling is that anti-PD-1 might be better because it blocks the receptor. And anti-PD-L1 will block only the ligand, and there is another ligand There may be other ligands that we don't really know about. So it's probably better to block the receptor. That's just the general feeling. I don't think we know entirely which one will be better.
Although this man had, it looks like, a very good response to the PD-L1 agent. Any tolerability issues with the checkpoint inhibitor in this man? Any side effects, any problems at all?
Not in this particular gentleman, no.
Just out of curiosity, and of course, obviously this comes up in every cancer that these agents are being used, what have your observations been in terms of tolerability and toxicity, particularly for the PD-1 antibodies?
It's been very well tolerated. Generally speaking, there is low-frequency pneumonitis. But other than that, we haven't really seen a whole lot. But the moment you add anti-CTLA-4, you will get autoimmune. Because anti-CTLA-4 is, you know, we evolved to have that for upregulation or activation of Tregs. So the T regulatory cells that suppress the immune system are caused by the CTLA-4. So when you suppress that, you reduce the population of Tregs, and then you get autoimmunity, because that's what Tregs are for in our body, to suppress the autoimmune responses.
So I've been asking this question ever since I heard about people responding to PD-1 antibodies with gastric cancer. And so far, nobody's had an answer for me, but maybe you will, which is, you mentioned that there's, you know, a fair number of patients with MSI-high gastric cancers. I've heard people say 20-25%. And of course, we know that in general, MSI-high cancers seem to respond to checkpoint antibodies. Do we know whether the people with gastric cancer who are responding are the ones who are MSI high or not? In other words, have they been correlated?
So there is a correlation. So there are two types of correlation. One is MSI high. If you really had MSI high population, suppose you had 10 patients, I think 8 of them will respond. If you had PD-L1 expressing tumor patients, then the percentage drops. It's down to like 20%. So I think MSI-high actually may be more favorable population for immune modulation.
But there are patients with gastric who respond who are not MSI-high.
That is correct, yes.
You were referring before to the issue of stemness and stem cell activity, and I know you've had an interest in this area. I'm curious where we are today, not just in gastric cancer, but in other cancers. There have been reports in pancreatic, for example, but in general, where things are right now with, you know, the concept of anti-stem cell therapy, and from a clinical research point of view, where we stand on that strategy?
So I think, you know, there was a lot of question about whether the cancers are organized just like the normal tissue, where the stem cells are lurking, you know, not animated state, but they are just residing in the adult tissue and getting animated only when there is injury. So there's a lot of resistance to that theory. But now I think more people have stopped arguing. I think people now believe that most cancers have stem cells, cancer stem cells. And the cancer actually occurs because of damage to the adult normal stem cells. So for example, in Barrett's carcinoma, the theory is that many cells are damaged by GERD, like a reflux, and inflammatory environment. But we know that most of the cells in our body, they are destined to die because they have limited number of proliferation left, and then they will die. Only the stem cells can self-replicate and have infinite replication cycles in them because of the type of genes they use. So those are the cells that will survive the inflammatory milieu and acquire DNA alterations that somehow they are not repaired, and then they will become malignant. And so once it becomes malignant, then it will have progeny, early progenitor cells and late progenitor cells, and that will make the mass, and there will be small number of cancer stem cells. So in gastroesophageal cancer patients, we know about STAT3, for example, is very upregulated. The hedgehog pathway is upregulated. The Hippo pathway is upregulated. and particularly YAP, which is not getting a lot of attention, but many of the cancer pathways will converge to YAP. And this has been shown by us and actually shown more by others, that even if you think about the RAS and MEK pathway or BRAF and some of the other oncogenic like PI3 kinase, mTOR, everything sort of ends up in YAP, which is the bottleneck. But we don't have a YAP1 inhibitor in the oncology space at the moment. So we have STAT3 inhibitor that the papers that you had pointed out. I think there should be an attempt to suppress this cancer stem cells along with inhibition of the checkpoints.
So there was a paper, actually it was a trial in progress paper. I really like those submissions, the so-called BRITER trial, a phase 3 randomized double-blind study of BBI-608 and weekly paclitaxel versus placebo. Can you talk a little bit about what this agent is and why it is that now it's being studied in a phase 3 setting?
Right. So this is a molecule which is a STAT3 inhibitor, and it has been rather slow. This trial has been going on for a long time. I think it's in the second line setting. We are not participating in this trial, but I think it's an important trial because it is probably one of the only trials that is directly addressing the cancer stem cell population. So being a STAT3 inhibitor, the issues with that molecule is a lot of data before this trial is really with combination. So we don't really know as a single agent whether it is, you know, effective or not. But I think it will be an important trial if it is completed. There are going to be some complications because that area has moved on quite a bit. So there will be question about, is it better than ramucirumab plus paclitaxel? That will be an immediate question because that's an approved combination. But I'm looking forward to the results.
So I want to get back to your patients. You mentioned ramucirumab a couple times, and maybe you can talk about your 59-year-old man with HER2-negative gastric cancer who started out on oxaliplatin 5-FU, had a response, then had disease progression, almost grade 2 neuropathy with the progression, then got irinotecan, capecitabine, progression of first evaluation. What happened at that point?
So I want to make just one point for my colleagues here. You know, we have good data with paclitaxel ramucirumab. So that's why we shouldn't use a taxane in the first line setting. Because if you add a taxane and make the tumor resistant to taxane, you will not get the benefit of the combination. Because paclitaxel ramucirumab mostly is driven by paclitaxel. And ramucirumab, of course, adds more to it. But then you will sort of end up with ramucirumab alone. So that was one point. The second point is how we approach this particular patient. So if you get considerable neuropathy with the first line therapy, you cannot jump into paclitaxel ramucirumab either. So that's the problem. So in that circumstance, I would recommend that you use irinotecan-based regimen and then save paclitaxel ramucirumab for the third line, which is approved. The insurance companies actually don't deny the use in the third line setting.
What about ramucirumab alone? There was an entire trial that looked on that, and even though the data weren't as impressive as with the taxane, it was a positive trial. What about that, and particularly a patient with serious neuropathy?
Yeah, you can try that, but as we discussed earlier, that the response rate is very low. It's only 3%. And the positivity, you know, the p-value was 0.47. The upper bound of 95% confidence interval was 0.998. If it had been 0.1, which was very close to 0.1, then it would be a negative trial. So I think it barely made it, and it doesn't really have clinically meaningful impact on patients. So I don't use it alone, and I recommend to people to try to use it with paclitaxel.
What have you observed in terms of tolerability issues? We did a poll of investigators recently, asked them what they had observed. We heard about hypertension and fatigue. What have you observed?
Ramucirumab, you will have like a close to 10 to 15% hypertension that requires additional management. I usually have to send my patient to my internal medicine colleague to manage. And then there's nosebleed, which is very frequent. And then occasionally you will have bowel perforation. That's not common. Thromboembolism is not very common. Generally speaking, it's a well-tolerated molecule.
I was surprised that people said fatigue. Have you observed that?
Well, it's kind of hard to separate that from all the stress and cancer that patients have. I'm not sure if fatigue by itself is caused by this molecule. I'm not sure of that.
So what happened with this patient? The paclitaxel ramucirumab was started then what? That was, I guess, third line at that point.
Yes. So he had, I think it was only for a short time that he had stable disease. So it's a difficult situation in the clinic for all our patients with advanced gastroesophageal adenocarcinoma because we don't really don't have much going on. Fortunately, there are a lot of phase one trials at my institution, so we can get them on a number of those studies.
Well, you also wrote down that you were thinking about a PD-1 antibody.
That's right. That's right. We're trying to get, but not every patient gets approval. Some people can afford it themselves. Sometimes the insurance company pays, and sometimes we appeal directly to the pharma and we are successful.
Getting back to ramucirumab, where do you see it heading? Is it being looked at in earlier stage disease? And I'm curious because I'm starting to hear people talk about combining anti-angiogenics with checkpoint inhibitors. I've heard about that with Bev. Any thoughts about combining ramucirumab with a checkpoint inhibitor?
Yeah, it's already being done. So one thing about the angiogenesis is the expression of VEGF is another mechanism of resistance. And so whenever you threaten the tumor, it will upregulate all these molecules that it knows it will need for survival. So angiogenesis is one of those. And so ramucirumab, even in T cells, there is upregulation of VEGF. And I don't quite understand that, but so they are combining anti-angiogenic agent with PD-L1 inhibitor because it's just a milieu of resistance where you may get an advantage. Theoretically, it makes sense to use anti-angiogenic agents, but in practice, they don't work as well, especially in GI tumors. Their effect is only very borderline. That's probably because we haven't quite learned how to use them or we don't have the right molecules.
So you mentioned earlier the patient who had gotten neoadjuvant chemo radiation therapy in the hope of going to surgery, but then this pleural mass was found. And you actually had a patient here that you wanted to present, a 41-year-old woman who got neoadjuvant chemo radiation, Asian extract, no family history, with diffuse types of gastric cancer in the upper half of the stomach, T3N0, laparoscopy, negative for malignant cells, PET is negative, no mets are noted. So can you talk a little bit about how you saw her situation at that point and how the surgeon saw her?
Right. So this patient, you know, there are a couple of things about this particular lady. One is a diffuse type of gastric cancer, which is usually using glutamine for energy source rather than glucose. So it doesn't have the GLUT1 receptors, you know, that we use for the PET scan. So PET scan depends on the GLUT1 receptor for glucose to go inside. Glucose and vitamin C use that receptor to enter the cells. So often these cells don't have a lot of GLUT1 receptor upregulated. So the PET scan is usually negative. There can be a big tumor, but you won't find avidity by using glucose in the PET scan. So what we have published on is very interesting finding is that when the PET scan is negative in gastric cancer, the prognosis is worse. And when the PET scan is positive in esophageal cancer, the prognosis is better. And that's because of this diffuse type of cancer where the PET scan is negative. So it's better to have positive PET scan in gastric cancer because that reflects moderately differentiated, well-differentiated tumor. So in this particular lady, she underwent surgery and there was a lot of tumor, node positive disease. And so we are now checking for PD-L1, and there is going to be a trial. This will be the first such trial in this space where the patients who have no evidence of cancer, in other words, you have successful surgery, but they are at high risk for subsequent relapse. In those patients, they will be randomized to anti-PD-1 versus observation, 2-to-1 randomization. So we need something for this group of patients. So this lady, the prognosis is not necessarily very good.
So how is she being treated?
So she is not being treated right now because it's still early. And essentially, we will check for PD-L1 in the residual tumor. And if it is positive, then we'll explore. So she cannot get on this trial that I mentioned to you because of, you know, multiple reasons. But we'll explore the anti-PD-1 therapy if the tumor is PD-L1 positive.
So basically, if you were to treat her now, it'd be adjuvantly, correct?
We'll be adjuvantly, but suppose we didn't have anti-PD-1 molecule, then she will not receive any therapy because we already gave her a lot of treatment before surgery. So at my institution, we give chemotherapy first for a couple of months, then we do chemo radiation. And so we have already done a lot of therapy for her. Had she been in Japan, for example, she will go straight to surgery and then she will get adjuvant chemotherapy. So in Japan, she will get S1, and in Korea, she will get capecitabine oxaliplatin.
And what would you estimate right now, roughly, is her risk of relapse?
I would say it's very high. It would be close to 60%.
But I would understand that if you could, you would use a PD-L1 antibody in her adjuvantly.
Well, this is just an individual case. You know, it will not be a trend in my practice, but this is a young lady. She doesn't have any germline. We check for BRCA. We check for CDH1. She probably has some other alteration in her germline DNA that led to this aggressive tumor. So, you know, it's trying to do something for her, but it's not setting a trend for anti-PD-1 adjuvant therapy without a trial.
I'm curious, you chose to give her chemo radiation therapy. We did a poll recently of investigators and found that some people don't use the radiation part. They only use neoadjuvant chemo. Any thoughts about that?
So that's a valid approach also. In fact, we started that strategy. We're the first to publish on that. And then we published several more papers. So I think that's a reasonable strategy where you do chemotherapy first, then you do surgery, then you try to do more chemo afterwards, and most patients cannot tolerate that. Then, as you well know, in US, we did the post-operative chemo radiation trial that was positive. And then just recently, the Dutch trial that compared pre-op chemo followed by surgery to post-op chemo to pre-op chemo followed by surgery to post-op chemo radiation. So basically, in that critics trial, both groups got the same pre-op therapy, they got the same surgery, but the post-op therapy was different. And it kind of put to rest the idea of giving post-operative chemo radiation if you do good surgery. So the difference between the critics trial and the intergroup trial that established adjuvant chemo radiation was the quality of surgery was very poor in the intergroup trial. But when you do good surgery, chemo radiation doesn't work afterwards. And there is another trial from Korea called the ARTIST trial, which has about 600 some patients. All patients had very good surgery. So they all had surgery first, and then they were randomized to chemotherapy or chemo radiation, and there was no difference. So that's the second trial showing that if you do good surgery, you don't need to do chemo radiation. Now this is incorporated in the NCCN guideline also.
And of course, this critics trial was presented at the last ASCO meeting. You referred to the concept of, quote, good surgery. How is good surgery defined? What is it that's making it better surgery? Less complications, better cancer control?
Right. So I think the good surgery begins with a good surgeon, a high-volume surgeon at a high-volume center. A good surgery is really defined by lymph node dissection, the level of lymph node dissection. So there are two groups of nodes that we focus on. One is along the greater curvature and lesser curvature. Those are called D1 nodes, and they are numbered. So we don't need to actually define which one is where. But there's a second group of lymph nodes along the big blood vessels that also need to be dissected out. So that will be the D2 dissection. So what the Dutch trial did, the CRITICS trial, is they did D1 plus. That means they did not dissect all the D2 nodes, they dissected some of them. And I really have to talk to them about finding out exactly, you know, what constitutes D1 plus. But it's much better surgery than is being done around the country here, because we have very few gastric cancer patients in the country, relatively speaking. And so occasional surgeon will operate on those patients, and they don't do a good job because they're not experienced.
Another controversial question when we ask the investigators, we get very mixed responses related to neoadjuvant therapy. Goes back to what we were talking about before, which is HER2-positive disease. And the question is, if you know a patient has HER2-positive disease, you're going to be giving neoadjuvant therapy. Should you include anti-HER therapy such as trastuzumab? Obviously, that's done in breast cancer. I don't think we have any data that I know about in gastric cancer. On the other hand, we know that it's going to introduce very little toxicity tolerability issues, although there will be an expense. Do you add an anti-HER therapy neoadjuvantly?
No, we don't, because actually in the guidelines that are going to be published, we don't even recommend testing HER2 with localized, you know, patients with localized disease, because we have no data. So, you know, you can do this test if you want, but what are we going to do with that? So there's no data in either preoperative setting or postoperative setting if the HER2 is overexpressed. So at my institution, we don't even do it. I know some institutions, they routinely do it. It doesn't matter whether tumor is localized or metastatic. They do it in everybody. But I wouldn't recommend treatment or doing the test.
I'm going to ask you about another paper you were involved with. You mentioned before Barrett's. This was a paper in the journal Gastroenterology, Quality Indicators in the Management of Barrett's Esophagus Dysplasia and Esophageal Adenocarcinoma. I realize this paper was about quality, but could you just talk a little bit about this whole clinical scenario and what we know about it and what this group recommends in terms of management?
So Barrett's is a very interesting phenomenon. There are some very elegant papers published in Nature Genetics, I think, last year. So first of all, just clinically speaking, Barrett's is produced by our body to withstand acid, because normally the squamous epithelium is protected by the sphincter that we have. When the sphincter gets incompetent because of truncal obesity or some other issues, then the acid and bile goes and exposes to squamous mucosa, which is not physiologically made to withstand those chemicals. So you produce Barrett's, and Barrett's can withstand acid and bile. But it's the chronicity of the injury that results in evolution of Barrett's, from the metaplasia to dysplasia, different grades of dysplasia. So in fact, when you think about Barrett's by itself, it's a good thing to have Barrett's if you got reflux, because it's protecting squamous epithelium. People are thinking about Barrett's as a bad thing. So there is a small group of patients with Barrett's that will convert to adenocarcinoma. And those two papers, one was from US and one from UK, showed that it's really the loss of tumor suppressor genes, there are three of them, loss of function or loss of DNA, that results in what they call oncogenic amplification. So as we know that all these proliferative processes in our body, they're regulated by tumor suppressor and corresponding oncogene. So if you remove the tumor suppressor, the oncogene automatically functions more, and it will cause proliferation. So what happens in Barrett's, you lose P16, you lose TGF-beta, SMAD4, and you lose P53, and the corresponding oncogenes get amplified and then result in oncogenic expression, which is the carcinoma. So the other thing to note is that there are two pathways. One is where there is a slow loss of each tumor suppressor over years, and then you ultimately get cancer. And there is a faster route where you just lose P53, and then you have oncogenic overexpression and formation of cancer. So that's one important observation. The second one is that if you take one resected specimen with Barrett's and carcinoma, and you do molecular profiling, say, for example, 10 different areas, you will get a different trajectory. There may be some founder mutations, but then later on, it's all context-dependent, different projections using different oncogenes and so on. So there's a lot of clonal evolution. This we knew from Brian Reed, 30 years ago. He was talking about this aneuploidy and clonal stuff. Now we know that molecularly. So I'm mentioning all this because, people talk about treatment. It's not going to be one treatment. These are all so heterogeneous. And only the competent one becomes cancerous. The others will either die or will have delayed cancer. So what is happening in the community is low-grade and high-grade dysplasias are being ablated. Some people want to ablate the Barrett's too, and I think that's wrong because Barrett's is actually protective. So till it deteriorates into dysplasia, there's no need to treat it. And of course, early carcinoma can be treated. So along the same lines, the endoscopic therapy is getting so sophisticated now that we can preserve the esophagus in many, many patients that we did. We took high-grade Barrett's patients to surgery. I remember sitting in the tumor board and insisting that the given patient should go to surgery because they had this high-risk lesion. We don't have to do that anymore. We can preserve their esophagus. The only thing is patient has to be very compliant so that we can continue to survey them and treat them as needed. So I don't know if that answers your question. There's microbiome there. There are lots of other very good things are happening in that area.
Anything else that we haven't talked about today that you want to comment on?
So I think we talked a lot about early stage and localized disease and metastatic. But I think the most important thing to recognize is that gastric cancer is a big burden on global society. There are nearly 1 million cases every year and 700,000 deaths. That number may be a little bit higher, maybe 500,000 deaths. So anyway, when you walk into the clinic and see these patients and their families, we're really offering them very little. The progress is very, very slow. And one reason is because it's not such a big Western disease, so we don't invest so much in gastric cancer. And I recently heard a podcast where Harold Varmus spent a whole hour talking about, his career. And then towards the second half, he says, gastric cancer is one of the biggest problems in the world. And we really should learn more. And he was talking about viruses, so basically talking about EBV. But he brought that up. But I remind everybody that NCI or NIH or now DOD is listing gastric cancer in their cancer funding, but that started only last year. NIH has not set aside any funds for gastric cancer. We have to compete with everybody in the, big pot of money for all cancers. So I think we need that because we really haven't made much progress. For example, metastatic patients, their median survival is under 1 year. Colon cancer, we're just about reaching 3 years, median survival. And we started the same place. When I started doing medical oncology, I was seeing colon cancer patients. They were dying within a year. with metastatic disease. Then we developed all these different molecules, different technology, you know, resecting liver lesions and making them resectable and resecting. So they have benefited a lot. We know a lot more molecular biology of colon cancer than we know about gastric cancer. So I'm hoping that something will change.
This concludes our program. And if you'd like to have a case from your practice presented to one of our program faculty, please email me your case at drneillove@researchthepractice.com. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for GI Cancer Update.